tell me. And as I've been on that journey, I've just realized that, well, my assumption is that if you're in this room, you probably are in some kind of cross-cultural relationships. And my other assumption is that if you're in cross-cultural relationships, there's probably tension at times, frustration. I mean, that's how it is with any relationship with two sinners, right? I mean, in a marriage, how many people don't have frustrations in their marriage? But often within cross-cultural relationships, we don't realize that just as in a marriage, how it's very important to try to understand where the other person's coming from, that we need to do that in our cross-cultural relationships as well. And so for what I've run into a lot of times is a lack of communication. It seems like we're coexisting and we're living, but we're not living in these relationships of rich depth that allows us to really create that synergy, ultimately for the glory of God and the advancement of the gospel. And so my heart is that the communication would be open and that we would be able to learn and understand from each other. And what I've found, though, is a lot of times Caucasian people, well, sometimes we don't even realize that there's tension. And if we do realize, sometimes we don't care because we just think, well, people need to get over it because my way is the right way. But more often than that, I think we just don't even know where to start. We don't know the questions to ask. We don't know where to start the conversation or where to start learning. Or we're afraid that if we start speaking that we're actually going to confirm that we're racist and people are going to be offended at us, or we're going to say something that's going to make someone mad. And so a lot of times we just don't talk. And as with a lot, not all, but with a lot of minorities that I know, it seems like the situation is that people are tired. They're tired of having to defend themselves and explain themselves all the time. They're tired of bearing their souls just to be kind of discounted as, oh, you're being oversensitive, or have people walk away when they're honest with how they're feeling. And because of this, communication doesn't happen. And we don't ultimately live in the kinds of relationships that I think that we could, that would really express God's glory. And so what my job is here today is not to tell you all those things, but to ask the questions. I'm going to ask the questions. This wonderful panel of people who have been experiencing cross-cultural relationships for a long time in a variety of different ways are going to answer the questions. And just as a quick side note, I'm not expecting you'll meet David and Alvin and Dingo and Juanita and Scott. I'm not expecting David to answer for all Korean Americans. He is not the representative of his race. He's the representative of himself and what he's seen to be true, just as Alvin is not a representative for all African Americans, et cetera, et cetera. So let's get started, because I really don't want to take up a bunch of time with me talking. I want to take up the time with them talking. So we'll start maybe. Can you guys kind of see these guys, or do they need to stand up when they talk? Stand up, is that going to be easier? Yeah, I mean, if people could move closer, that would maybe make it easier. But well, let's start by having you guys introduce yourself. And if you guys can make sure to speak into the microphone, we'll just start at this end with David. And then, David, if you can just in a couple minutes just basically tell us your name and just a little bit about your context.
Hi, my name's David Park. I'm a second generation Korean-American, which is the first generation to be born in the United States. I was born in Dallas, Texas, and my current context is living in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm at a church called Open Table Community Church. It's in the Chamblee-Doraville area, if you're familiar with Atlanta at all. But Chamblee is often referred to as the Samaria of Atlanta because everybody passes through there, but nobody stays. That's actually a place where a lot of refugees, Southeast Asians, South Americans tend to come. Open Table is a little bit unique in the sense they were actually a middle-class white suburban church, and God gave them a call to move to this part of the town, which, obviously, I said white, Hispanic, Southeast Asian, not a whole lot of Koreans there, but my friend and I, a few friends of mine and I, we ended up there by the grace of God, and we're trying to do church there, and it's been fun. Yeah, in quotes, depending on how you define fun. It's been different. I think that for all of us, it's been, once you're out of a homogenous context, suddenly you become very aware of yourself and the differences in others. So it's been a very interesting context to be kind of in. I don't know if you're familiar with Georgia, but it's not exactly known to be the most multi-ethnic and diverse population. It's not exactly San Francisco or Boston, someplace like that, but it's rapidly growing in its Asian population, rapidly growing in its Hispanic population, and I think you know, this large city of the South has not had to deal with these issues, but that's where I'm at.
Well, my name is Alvin Sanders. I serve as the Chief Diversity Officer for the Evangelical Free Church of America. And prior to that, I planted and pastored a church about 3 minutes from here called River of Life Church. Some of you may remember in the spring of 2001, Cincinnati had some racial riots over the shooting death of an African-American young man by a white police officer. Well, our church got started that week in about 400 feet from where the officer was shot. I mean, where the young man was killed. So we sort of had baptism by fire in multi-ethnic, multi-racial, multi-social class, multi-everything church. And I'm happy to say that the church has been a witness in this community, and the Lord has moved me on to continue that witness with the Evangelical Free Church of America.
My name is Mandia Gordon, and I'm actually from New Orleans, Louisiana. And my job is, I'm the sports director there. So basically, I just run all the sports, which is, it's pretty fun for me because my job is to play basketball and to share the gospel. So I love doing it, and plus I get paid for it, so it's good. But the church I attend is pretty half and half, about 50% black, 50% white. So it's a good church to be at, just to experience, you know, different cultures. So.
Good afternoon. My name is Juanita Irizarry, or Juanita Irizarry, whichever one you can pronounce. My father is a New Yorican, in other words, a Puerto Rican born in New York, for those of you who don't know what that is. My mom is a white lady who thinks she's Puerto Rican, but whose roots actually trace back to the Mayflower. So I am a bicultural experiment, just by being, and my life has been a lot about building bridges across folks from all different walks of life. I live today in Humboldt Park in Chicago, which is where I've lived my entire life. It's the heart of the Puerto Rican community in Chicago, also with a lot of Mexicans, some African Americans, and newly arrived, mostly white folks as the neighborhood gentrifies. I go to church there at River City Community Church, which is a multiracial church that is trying to figure out what it means to pursue social justice and community development in that gentrifying context where most of the whites and Asians in the church are the newly arrived gentrifiers. They don't necessarily know that, but that's what they are. And most of the Latinos and African Americans are, you know, part of the incumbent population that is getting displaced. So in that midst of that context, we try to work on loving one another across race and class lines. And my work has been in the secular world in affordable housing and economic development and public policy.
My name is Scott Lundeen. I get to be the white guy in a conversation about race. I actually mean that. I get to. It's a privilege for me to be part of this conversation. I'm looking forward to our time. It was 91, this fall of 1991, that I went from Bethel College, where I was going to school, to North Minneapolis to check out the Hospitality House. And when I went, I drove in. It's in a black neighborhood there in Minneapolis. And I drove in, and as I drove in, I thought, if I walk anywhere here, I might get shot in this community. You know, from all of my images growing up in rural Minnesota, that was my image of the big city and especially the black community. And so over that year, I volunteered and got involved with Hospitality House. And remember, one time I was working the desk at the club there, and somebody called in, and she was asking, who's up there at the club? And I said, well, Junebug's here, and Nook's here, and, you know, I named some people that are there. And she said, well, what kind of car do you drive? You know, and I started telling the car I drive, and then she said, are you light-skinned? And I said, I'm really light-skinned. I'm white. And I felt like when I hung up the phone, man, I've arrived. You know, she thought I was black. But I remember that being a process for me of figuring out how do I do these things. You know, for the first time in hospitality, I was playing basketball in a gym where I'm the white guy. And so for me, that was the beginnings of this kind of experience as a bit of the minority experience. For me, lived in La Vallita, a little village in Chicago for summer. 5.5 years, my wife and I lived in New Orleans, African-American neighborhood there. Now we're in Denver and working with Mile High Ministries to produce short DVDs that are
full of that. That we don't, like the world, just blame the fallen powers of the world, because after all, we are the ones who have the spirit and have the power to redeem those fallen powers. Which in turn makes it very part of our responsibility to point out those things that those who may be poor are doing that aren't of high character, without demonizing them and making them feel belittled. Because the reality is, we are all sinners and we all fall short of the glory of God. It's just that you pay more for some sins than you do others. So, you know, when we're talking about meritocracy, when we're talking about white privilege, yes, these things are prevalent, these things are out there, but at the end of the day, we have to realize that we're beyond sociologists, we're beyond people who are just trying to make peace in the world. What we're trying to do is we're trying to actually represent the kingdom of God, which rises above all of that. And if we don't intentionally engage ourselves, we'll just be another nonprofit organization. We'll just be another sociologist or bad sociologist, because most pastors and ministers make very bad sociologists. So I think, you know, there's a saying that says, keep the main thing, the main thing, the main thing. Let all these other entities and all these other realities inform our faith, but we must be careful that it does not dominate and take over our faith, because then we will make the mistake of thinking that we can just borrow from the social sciences and that will change our situation. As somebody who's tried to pastor a church in the middle of a race riot, trust me, if Jesus ain't on the scene, it doesn't matter. So I would say, I don't even know if I answered the question, but I would say that, you know, what troubles me about these conversations is I don't know if we do enough of the interweaving of the scriptures and the power of the spirit within all of these other things that we talk about. I guess that's what I'm really trying to say. That's what I'm really trying to say. So meritocracy, you know, is it a myth? Is it not a myth? People will battle over that. But I do know this. I do know that if we use ourselves as incarnational vessels of the power of Jesus Christ, we can overcome the meritocracy myth. We can overcome the white privilege and the things that happen to people because of the color of their skin. And we can be witnesses for the world of what can happen when people of God come together and trust that the Spirit is going to move, that we are going to be, we are going to live differently, and we are going to be incarnational people. I do know that that is the key to a lot of this stuff. And being able to engage these things, engage these issues as fallen powers, but yet then understand that our power lies within the Spirit and within our faith in Christ.
For me, growing up was very different, and to be honest, I was always that type of guy that kind of wanted to put things like this to the side. Like, I never even heard of the word meritocracy, and I never even heard of the term white privilege, actually, until I came to CCDA, and I just turned 21, so that's 21 years in life that I went on basically living my life not even knowing that these terms existed. And if I did come across, I kind of just put them to the side, because I was always that type of guy who wanted to basically just get along, you know, even though if you came from a different neighborhood or if you came from the suburbs, yeah, I'm from the hood, but let's just, you know, our common ground, especially if you were Christian, is that my goal in life is not to debate and discuss these things. Yeah, they exist, but to aim toward and be more like Christ. So when Roots first asked me to be on the panel and I saw this, I'm just like, oh, what does it even mean? But it exists. Where I'm from, it definitely exists. Just to speak a little bit on white privilege, you know, I just see it as it's being a privilege to be white, I guess. That would be my definition. And the example I want to use is that I have a Land Rover. But before you go into like, what, you're 21, it only costs $6,000. So I got to steal pretty much. But anyway, the neighborhood I live in, it's pretty predominantly black, you know, a lot of African Americans. And anytime I'm driving, I get pulled over by the cops. And the first question they ask is that, who called it for? And I get sad because I say that because I'm black and that I'm young, that I can't be driving a Land Rover. You know, it's not expected of me to be driving this type of car. And it hurts me because why can't a black man be driving a Land Rover? It's just a car, right? People make money, they save money. If they have the money to buy a Land Rover, then let it be. But so I say, let's switch it. If I was a white person, you know, would I get pulled over for driving a Land Rover? And the answer is no. And I was kind of joking around with a friend of mine. He was like, well, if you threw some rims on it and some tinted windows, they wouldn't pull you over, because every black person have rims and tinted windows on their car, no matter what kind of car it is. But I guess sometimes it's just like, all right, why can't I be in a category where it really doesn't matter? That, yeah, I'm black, yeah, I'm young, but I can drive any kind of car if I want. If I was driving a Hoopty, would the police pull me over? Probably not. But for me, I guess I'm kind of still in the process of learning. As I hear these people speak, and I'm kind of learning new things, you know, as I speak right now, you know, I never really thought of, like I said earlier, these terms. So meritocracy, I would say that when I hear people say, all right, I made it based on what I've done, you know. And I guess living in the place I live, I guess a lot of people, I guess you can say that they don't succeed, or they not, you know, put in that place where people see them as a person who made it out, because opportunities are not given to them. Like growing up, we didn't have, I just think about basketball. If you went to a predominantly white school and you was on a basketball team, you had the right weight. Like you can lift weights, the machines actually worked and stuff like that. So that would better you to become a better basketball player. But the school I went to, we didn't even have the equipment we needed to become. Yeah, we had some skills, but I would say if we had those, you know, tools and those opportunities like that, we would, you know, become better at that. But I think about just the opportunities that we were given growing up are not as much as you see in other places. So that's basically what I have to say on white privilege and meritocracy. I don't know if I answered it, but I'm still kind of learning on all of this. So if I didn't answer it, forgive me, please.
How about, let's just move on to the next question. How often do you think about your race? Or how often does your race come into just your consciousness as you're interacting in life? Scott, you want to answer that question?
Yeah, for me, this kind of follows up on that conversation. Is I probably spent 18 years of my life not really having to think about being white. You know, it wasn't something that I thought about at all. And then, or hardly ever, unless I see something on TV that, you know, White Bear Lake was playing Minneapolis North on TV, and I maybe thought about the fact that I was white. But otherwise, I'm not thinking about it. And then when I'm playing basketball and I'm in the gym and I'm the white guy, then I'm thinking about it. And so now it's on my mind a lot. I still don't think I think about it as much as people of color probably think about it, but it's now something I think about a lot. It affects how I think about other things as well. I, you know, and it wasn't until being in the gym, that experience was having a Chicano friend and a white friend that went to a Nuggets basketball game in Denver, and the Chicano friend got checked twice on his tickets because they had great tickets in the front, and they got checked. He got checked twice. The white guy didn't ever get checked. Those kind of things that I start to realize. So it's not just that I don't think about white, but that I didn't think about that I'm driving, a Lexus, or whatever. It's like it didn't think about color, and this is the process that I'm on now, realizing the ways that color also comes with a lot of privilege that comes with it.
I would say I think about it all the time, every day, because of the context in which I live and work, and because I'm bicultural. I grew up in a Puerto Rican neighborhood where people looked at me and didn't quite know what to think, because I'm not really, don't look like the stereotypical Puerto Rican, maybe. But my name is Juanita, I have a little brother whose name is Joey. And he's just as half white and half Puerto Rican as I am, but nobody really asked him about his race or his culture because his name was Joey and he looked white. I just figured this out in the last few months, actually, and I haven't had a conversation with my brother about it, but I actually think that the fact that my name is Spanish and his name is English made a difference in how the world received us. And it made me, at a much younger age, have to start thinking about the question when people ask me, what are you, or what nationality are you, or whatever, because I remember conversations like that, when I was 5 or 6 riding my bike in the neighborhood. So I spend a lot of time translating for people in conversations about race and ethnicity, being in a very bicultural church or multicultural church. So it's always on my mind, because when I go to my Bible study group where everybody is white, I'm always saying, oh, but that's not how a lot of people in this neighborhood experience that thing. And then I go to a gathering of our Latino group, which is very immigrant dominant, mostly Spanish speakers. And I get frustrated over there because they don't think about the Latinos who just have lived in the neighborhood for 3 generations and don't speak any Spanish. So my whole world is kind of a translation. In my neighborhood, our big joke in my neighborhood is, oh, there goes the neighborhood, when we see a white person walking their dog. Because the neighborhood is changing and it's really pushing out the lower income minority folks. And so, we have a fight in our community around whether the parks are for the dogs or the kids. And so, just the presence of all these folks and their dogs, it represents some tension. But I know that people see me walking down the street and they say, there goes the neighborhood, because they see a white person. So I'm like always on both sides and never quite sure where I fit in that. So for me, even though I don't experience a lot of discrimination directly and have a lot of white privilege as how I walk in the world, my reality as a bicultural person means that I think about it all the time.
I actually don't, because I live in a neighborhood where it's pretty much everybody's just like me and look the same. But as soon as I go out of my neighborhood, I'm kind of reminded of it, because, like I was saying, when I get pulled over by the cops, I'm like, all right, because I'm black. Or when I go to the mall, and me and my boys, they all have dreadlocks and stuff like that. Some of them, they like their clothes a little baggy, and we go in there, and the first things we get, we look around, and people start following us. And I say, oh, because I'm black, and my boys have dreads, So I don't often, when I'm in my neighborhood, I don't think about, oh, I'm black. And it's not that I forget when I leave. It's just the fact that, I'm the type of person that really don't try to think about those things. But I'm kind of reminded of that as soon as I go into somewhere else where it's not like my neighborhood. People have a different perspective and they see things a little bit different. So,
yeah, from my life experience, I'm aware of who I am and I'm proud of who I am, but it doesn't paralyze me. I grew up a military brat. So I figured out over the years I've grown up like a missionary kid, because I've lived in Japan, I've lived in Florida, I've lived everywhere. So I've sort of grown up what's called a third culture kid. And my parents grew up in deep South Alabama, and they came up under Jim Crow laws, and their whole deal with me was, you're black, so you must do everything with excellence. That's how you overcome your blackness. The things that might happen to you, the meritocracy, the white privilege or whatever. If you produce all that will take care of itself. So I don't, you know, yeah, I know I'm black, but it's not like I wake up and I go, oh, my God, I'm black, you know, or anything like that. It's like, yeah, I'm black. You know, and, you know, my pet peeve is I do presentations all the time and within the Evangelical Free Church, which is a traditional Northern European stock place, and they'll say, Alvin, I don't see a black man, you know, all that stuff. I'm colorblind. I said, well, if you don't see it, I'm 6'5", 270 pounds, and I'm black, something wrong with you. It don't bother me I'm black. Now, let's talk about why you made that statement. Because obviously something, like, oh, well, I didn't mean it. Well, all right, you know. So, you know, I'm aware of it. I'm proud of it. And I live life, and I can say that I've lived a life that I've been blessed enough that me being black has never stopped anything that I've done. I just, the Lord just put the circumstances around it that I've never had it thwart my development as a human being.
I don't know if I think about it as much as I don't, like, if there's a musician here, I don't know if you think about scales anymore after you've been playing music for a while, or maybe stick with our metaphor of cars. You don't think about driving. You just do it. And you see things, like you check the rearview mirror and you know what's behind you, but you don't even know that you've checked the rearview mirror. So I feel like I know I'm Asian. I don't have to check the mirror for that. But I'm aware of race all the time. If I meet new people, I know what race they are. I notice that. It's as much as if I notice if you're a male or female, young or old. My mind keeps that information, tracks that information. I'm very aware of myself because I was born in Dallas. I lived in Tulsa, Oklahoma. There were no Asians in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And there was one black girl named Fatima, and we were tight. Because it was just the two of us. But people would do crazy things. Just, my name is David. I have a Korean name, but I go by David. So when people would come up and say, ching chong, you know, egg roll, and I'm like, my name is David. Like, it doesn't even, you know, it's not like I romanized a Korean name. Like, you can't mess up David. My English is as good or better than yours. But people would come, you know, kids would come and body slam you, spit on you, punch you in the face. Not because my name was David, but because I was different. And so, to me, it took a long time. And how I think of race is very differently than how I used to think of race. Because as a child in that situation, I did not want to be Korean. I did not want to think of race. I did not want to think of myself as different. I remember I came home running home to my mom, and I said, why can't I have blonde hair and blue eyes? And, you know, my mom laughed it off because she came when she was adult. She didn't have to deal with any of that. And so, but as I grew older, and I think a lot of Asians feel this pressure because when it comes to meritocracy, if you make capitalism and education a game, Asians have rocked that game. You know what I'm saying? Like, what? I got to get a 1600, 2400 on the SAT? I could do that. What, I need to get into Ivy League school? I can do that. What does it take to drive a Beamer? I can drive a Beamer. I can buy a Beamer because that's how the second generation was born. When you have that immigrant mentality, it's like, we gave up everything for you to do well, so you better do well. So in terms of Asian Americans, we've mastered, I would say, to a great extent, meritocracy. But we've done that at the expense of our identity a lot of times. So there's a lot of self-hatred. There's a lot of eyelid surgeries, hair dyeing, breast augmentation to get away from looking Asian. We don't have any sense of memory or history. So if you ask, in general, a typical Asian American born in the United States, there's very little sense of history. And I think, to my eyes, and I know what you were saying earlier, Alvin, but I'd like to push back on that, to not push it aside, because I think there is a theological divine value in ethnicity and race that the church needs to explore again and ask, what is the value of maintaining that ethnic identity so that it enriches a multi-ethnic environment?
Yeah, give me that back, because you didn't hear me, bro, if you think I said push it aside, because I didn't say push it aside. That's not what I said. I didn't say minimize it either. I said don't let it dominate the main thing. That first, the primary identity we all have is our identity in Christ. Our secondary identity is our ethnic identity, our racial identity, our social class identity, our gender identity. That's all I'm saying. So all that definitely plays a role in it. and shaping our identity. And we need to factor all that in as we do our ministries. So that's all I'm saying. I'm not saying push it back. I'm not saying ignore it. Heaven forbid that, for sure.
And just to clarify, I mean, thanks for the clarification. I'm concerned, and, you know, Sinchon Ra voices a lot of the similar things, is that when we associate ourselves with an American identity, it tends to include vestiges of Western cultural captivity, from which I would say, as an Asian American who has been longing to be white, or who has had wrestled with that, with the notion of model minority and being able to economically overstep some of those bounds that are constricting other minorities, I feel like that's where, in the church, we haven't done a good enough job of saying God honors and has created your ethnic identity for a reason. For what reason, we don't know yet. But perhaps, just as in Esther's ethnic identity, which became very important, there will be a time such as this where it will play a big part.
Well, we have some questions. We can follow up with questions. Let me grab her first, and then I'll come back to you. Go ahead.
I would like to also push back on an issue about social institutions. Michael Emerson is a sociologist, a Christian sociologist, who's done research with the evangelical community. And he says basically that racism has morphed from this individualistic, very obvious public display of oppression into institutions. And if we're looking to do anything about bringing transformation to not just our lives personally, but in our community where we really need it desperately to develop solidarity, we must address those issues in the institution.
Right. Yes, we do need to. And actually, the conversation was just about to move to the institutional level. So,
I would just agree.
Yes, absolutely.
Book, and there's mm-hmm. also a good book by yep. Ronald Takahi. He's a Japanese-American who will give you a history of multiculturalism in the United States.
Okay.
And he'll give you some insights into how we got where we are.
Do you know what that? What was the name of that book?
Ronald Takahi is called A Different Mirror.
A Different Mirror. It and then Michael Emerson, where you Divided by Faith is what you were referring to. Yep. Yeah, so those are some titles you can write down if anybody's looking. Did you have a question or a statement? Or okay, let's hear it.
So, white privilege, meritocracy. I have access to things that my neighbors don't have access to. Right? I can make phone calls and get things done. When my black neighbor came to my house with his face swollen, asking for painkillers, and I inquired about what the problem was, and it was a dental problem, a serious dental problem, I make a couple phone calls the next day and take him to a friend of mine who's a dentist, but he couldn't do that. But then I discovered that he couldn't talk to the dentist very well. He couldn't communicate because he didn't know how to speak the language of the white dentist. So he had trouble communicating even to the receptionist. What the problem was pretty obvious, but he couldn't communicate his history. I live in Roanoke, Virginia, what I would term Jim Crow town, which means I go to a Jim Crow church. When I bring these things up to my pastors, they really don't understand. It's a Republican, it's a white Republican mindset. These are things as a member of the dominant culture, current dominant culture, I don't think about those things at all, and I have access. I have friends that I can call, but my neighbors, because I've relocated, they don't think about this. I don't think about this, but it's true. So all of a sudden, because I've moved to where now I'm the minority, because now I live in the hood. Now I am the minority. And I'm the guy with access among people who don't have access. So I'm starting to learn all these crazy, like, how screwed up I've been. But I'm not sure how to communicate that to my Jim Crow town, and my Jim Crow church, and my Jim Crow friends.
well-meaning, wonderful Christians that have a deep misunderstanding, as I do. So,
does anybody have a response? Or?
Say, help me understand what I do with this knowledge. I can't. You know, I'm on the borderline of hurt with these things, and happy to be here at CCDA to connect with other people who are maybe
not. Gotcha. Does anybody from the panel have? Well, let me. Were you responding to? Let me.
Did you?
Well, I want to say this, and sorry to get up and start talking, but and I'm proud of you, man, because my boss, he don't like to be called boss, but so my CEO for my company did the same thing for me. I go to a white dentist just because. My insurance don't check out. I got insurance just like anybody else that's white up in that dentist office has. But just because I was not white, they wasn't going to deal with me because I didn't have the proper language, as you may say. You know, my David said, my English is just as good as yours. I can speak Ebonics, I can speak Spanish, I can speak like two or three different languages. But just because I was black, they wasn't going to serve me. But by you being in your position, you probably just got a taste of what your calling is. You are the bridge to those people.
But you will. All it feels like
just because you got that guy in that dentist office that was the same.
You're all the experts.
Okay. So you are the bridge. You just got to define what the Lord is sending you to. But what I'm saying is, that's why if somebody is different, and I don't think that we should try to break down all the what is it called? Meritology? Where? But anyway, God works through that. God works through, look at some of the apostles that God had. He had a killer, a liar. God works through things that people deem that, it's just an outcast or whatever. But God has people just like you, people just like Kate, people just like all these people on this panel to work through that crap, to work through a white Republican town.
Thank you for your coming.
For the good of God,
you can finish your sentence and then I want to get back to the panel.
Okay,
go ahead.
Right. Be it through all hell, all pain, all tears, whatever, God can work through all of that. And you are the bridge, man.
Thank you.
I hope you hear that too, because I know when you're in your that spot, hearing that kind of affirmation means a ton. So thank you for that. I know, but for me, that's my passion. I was in New Orleans 3 years before Katrina, 2.5 years after Katrina came. We had people from around the country coming down saying, what about justice, race, poverty? We're watching on TV. How could this happen in America? All of a sudden, those issues, which the church wasn't addressing as much, all of a sudden came to the front, at least in individuals' minds as they watched it. And so I remember thinking, America's teachable right now. We need teachers. Do you know? And I've said this before this weekend, another setting, but I think of a guy who had a cause that was worth fighting for, giving his life for, that seemed so evident that something needed to be done. He moved for legislation on it. No movement on that issue. 26 years later, William Wilberforce gets movement on the issue of slavery. 26 years later. And so I know, at least for me, from my experience, there's been times when I've been so passionate about trying to communicate this, and I've got to step back and realize this is going to be a slow process. And adults, kids can just add on their education. You just give them something, and it'll add on to their education. Adults need disorienting dilemmas. They need something that disorients them. And for me, one of the great questions is, you know, for a white person, when I say I don't see you as black, to me, that's a compliment. I'm thinking, okay, race isn't an issue anymore. We have just a friendship, you know. But then I've learned as I've been around people of color, that's not a compliment. That's like saying to somebody who's a man, hey, I don't see you as a man, you know, anymore. You know, let's just have a friendship. I don't see you as a man anymore. It's like, what? And but that conversation is one of those kinds of opening conversations to get things started. But I'd love to talk with you more afterwards because I'm very passionate about what you're trying to do.
And just the other thing I would say is thank God for CCDA. I come to this conference every year just to be around people who don't think I'm crazy, you know, for how I've chosen to live, where I live. And I worked in the secular affordable housing world for a long time and wasn't necessarily amongst a bunch of Christians doing that work with me day to day, although a lot of them understood the work better than a lot of Christians I know. But you need a support system, whether it might not be people in your town, in your church right now, but are there people that you can be on email with among folks here who are going to understand what you're struggling with and who can pray with you and cry with you as you try to teach people little by little and just live with them? Now, I have a good friend who lives somewhere in Louisiana. We met each other in an airport. And, you know, I'm the only non-Republican Christian person, and it's not about Republican or Democrat, really, but that's a lot of how he talks about it with me, you know, who understands a lot of the things that we care about around justice. And he calls me and emails me because I just need somebody to talk to who understands the things I'm struggling with, because I go to my church and I get racist emails from people as we're talking about politics, or I get comments that don't sound biblical to me, and there's really nobody else around him to talk about that with. So you need a support system, and I'm just encouraging you to find part of that here and in other folks, even if they're not in your church, in your town, you know, right by you. But thank you for being there and doing that.
So you're talking, that actually just led me to think through another question, is within the Christian setting, how many of you work within Christian settings that are majority culture, or go to church within those settings? How is that for you? Are things just great because we're Christians and we just all get along? Or how does that play itself out?
Well, the Free Church, Evangelical Free Church of America, my job, is to be the contrarian voice. It's very tiring, extremely tiring, of constantly have to represent the other perspective. But on the other hand, it's a blessing, because the way I see it is my organization is one of the few in the evangelical world. I'm not talking about the other stripes of Christianity, but within the evangelical world that has European heritage that actually wants to change. So I see it more as a calling and more as trying to be trying to represent that alternate consciousness for the sake of the kingdom purposes. And someone out here said bridge builder, said the word bridge builder. I think it was you. And really, I think that for my experience has been, I see myself as a bridge. I get walked on from both sides. My African-American friends are like, why are you hanging with them white folk? The white folk don't understand me, you know. So it's like, all right, Lord, this is what you've called me to. And when you find my dead carcass on the road one day, somebody will say, oh, well, he did some good work. And the next person who comes after me, hopefully their walk will be much freer, without a lot of the stress and the strain that I've had to feel. But I feel like if you're going to go on the multi-ethnic, multicultural journey, it has to be a calling, because you're going to be living so differently than, I mean, sometimes I just go home and tell my wife, you know what, I just need to go find me a good missionary Baptist church and hoop and be done with all this. Some of y'all don't even know what hoop mean, but don't worry about it. You know, just go find me, you know, Broad Street Missionary Baptist Church and do my thing and die, you know. But I know that if the body of Christ is ever going to get this together, there has to be some people who are going to be willing to sacrifice comfort and willing to sacrifice just a lot of things in order to move the consciousness of the organization down the path that needs to go. Because it's not easy. It's definitely not easy.
I struggle a little bit with the idea that it's only the calling of some people to address racial and class reconciliation. I don't think we can love our neighbor and love God and not be addressing race and class issues in America. I think racism is, you know, one of the biggest, along with probably materialism, that keeps us from being what God calls us to be as a church, and just really hurts our witness. You know, we are no different than the mainstream. We're no different. We're worse in a lot of ways if you look at statistics around a number of things. I don't know. You know, I think everyone needs to talk to God about where their calling is. I'm sure there's some people that are supposed to live in small town Illinois where I went to Christian college, and there's nobody but white people. I mean, I'm sure there's some people that were called to be there. But I think most of us don't even ask that question. And we just go where we're comfortable and then maybe ask God to use us where we are. So I would challenge all of us that we're probably not meant to live in as much comfort as we tend to put ourselves in. And I think we need to be in discomfort about race and class issues in America if we're going to be the church.
David, did you have something you wanted to say or no?
I think it's very difficult, and as other people have already said, and I think as a minority, it's to be in a majority context again. You know, Monday through Saturday, you usually have to do that work or school, and then to make yourself vulnerable again in a place of worship is very difficult, because obviously that's why America is segregated on Sundays, because that's you want to be yourself around people like yourself. But I think it is very uncomfortable to put yourself, okay, on Sunday, I'm going to worship in a way that is not necessarily my way, in a voice that is not necessarily my voice. I think a lot of times it's painful by, you know, 100 paper cuts, very subtle slights, little things. And I'm really fortunate to be in a church where the leadership is daring, and is they will hear criticism. Your church is too white, and take that seriously and ask, well, what's so white about our church? Everything is white about your church. You know, whether it's the colors on the wall, whether it's the paintings we pick, whatever. So it's been really refreshing to be in a place where the leadership is seeing that and realizing that the community around the church and the community inside the church, although they're at this point they're vastly different, the tools that we need to engage one another are inside the building, not just outside the building. And some of those conversations have to happen inside before they happen outside.
Quick question?
Yeah, I appreciated what Juanita had to say as far as this idea of economic class bridging, because, you know, as much as I appreciate the conversation about the racial ethnic thing, that's one of the reasons I came to this particular workshop, because my experience has been that sometimes that's an even bigger jump. You know, it's a huge, huge leap, you know, and I just would love to hear.
Alvin, I know, has something to say about that.
The biggest problem in my 7 years of pastoring River of Life Church was not the race thing. It was the social class thing. It was, if I put two African American, a white, a Latino, and an Asian, which we all had in our church, if I put them all together and they were all in the same tax bracket, there were no fireworks. But if I took one of the white folk who migrated here from Appalachia and put them in the room with someone white who's just a urban, you know, yuppie, or a black from the hood, you know, from the projects, and a black from one of our upper middle class neighborhoods, that's when the fireworks happened. So I think that we have to be very careful in the 21st century of not just racializing things, because just because you're black doesn't mean you don't have access. I've grown up around black folk who have money. They have more access than white folk who have no money. I tell you that right now. So there's this other dynamic of social class that we really need to make sure that we address and that we look at, and not just stereotype and say, oh, well, because you're black, you don't have access, you know, and that type of thing. It's a very complicated issue that we must make sure that we're aware of all the things that play into the factors that keep people from getting access to different things.
I think, to me, one of the things that makes that conversation difficult is, I think, for middle-upper class, especially white, it becomes an easy out when we say, oh, yeah, it's just an economic issue. Race doesn't really matter anymore in America. Do you know? And so while what you're saying is true, I also know that I don't want it to be an easy out conversation. And so it's complex, yeah.
And I just want to give, like, a real-life example to that. You know, not just the easy out of addressing systemic oppression and poverty and all that and wanting to avoid that, but in the context of my church where I go now, it's very diverse, but I would say it's overwhelmingly middle class. There's some lower income folks, but so I'm going to put myself in there as one of the middle class people. You know, I've been to grad school twice. I know how to fit in American mainstream success and bicultural. But after a while, I get really irritated that I have to always walk in the white dominant culture in my church. So it's diverse, but it's still dominated by white styles of leadership, of music, of what time things should start and end, of, you know, whether we take off our shoes when we visit each other's homes or not. Whether, I mean, just all of these things. And I can do it, but it pisses me off that nobody ever does it my way. You know, even though I know how to do it. You know, so, and it's all, that's still class, but I mean, you know, my middle class Puerto Rican family has PhDs and, you know, law degrees and all this great stuff, but we still culturally do things differently. And, but our church still is dominated by white culture and style. So, and not every church is, but my church is. And we try. We sing some songs in Spanish now. It's really exciting. You know, I mean, we're doing some things, but it's still overwhelmingly those who are not white, who have learned how to be bicultural, at least bicultural, in order to be middle class and fit and participate in our society. We can do it. We do it all the time. But that no one ever accommodates us. That even if you're all in the same class, to me, that's still a big conversation that we need to have.
Go ahead. Yes.
I think it's good to remember our history that the whole thing about racial tension is because of racism. And racism, actually, the root of it is an economic issue. In the United States, labor brought here because of cheap labor, which is an economic issue. And we have a culture or civilization that builds from that, and then it morphs into the institution, it's still an economic issue. Now, the question is, we've made progress, which is to praise God. But we really, the percentages of people that are the dominant culture, Hispanic or African American, they're still in favor of the dominant culture. So we need to keep that in mind. We do have wonderful examples of progress, but there's still a whole class of people, because of the racialized institutions, do not have the same access, the same benefits. And that's what white privilege is all about. It's an economic power issue,
right,
not a cultural issue.
Well, and I think, go ahead, Scott.
I was just going to say, if what she's saying resonates at all, read the Divided by Faith, and you realize it's the net worth is 10 times for whites and the economic factor.
Right, and that's what, as panelists have mentioned, it's so complicated and intertwined, and it's hard to sometimes separate. And one last question. We're getting close to time. One last question. How, and this relates to some of the class stuff particularly, how does the majority culture who might be from the middle class when they are working in a lower class setting avoid paternalistic approaches? Or what does paternalism look like fleshed out? And actually, I'm going to have a follow-up to that if we have time. So, any thoughts on that? Paternalism, what paternalism looks like.
I have a lot of thoughts, and I've been talking a lot, so I'm going to try to make this short. But I mean, just the simple thing that I keep telling my friends in my small group at church is to stop trying to create new programs to help our community. And I say that because there are a lot of nonprofits and community development groups doing a lot of really good work in our community. And people move in and want to start a new program and want to be in charge of it and want to figure out what the problems are and run a program. And I keep encouraging my friends to just be and just get to know their neighbors and learn the community and figure out who's already doing really great stuff and participate with it. But we somehow have this need to always come in and be the savior and to know all the answers and to fix things rather than just being in relationship and in community with people.
Did anybody, David, did you have something? Or Alvin, go ahead.
I'll just tell a quick story of what paternalism looked like. When I was pastoring, basically from Thanksgiving to Christmas, I'd have like a gazillion suburban large white churches call me and tell me what we need for Thanksgiving and what we need for Christmas, without asking what we need. And then the other thing was, they would never expect us to have something to contribute to them. So they would call and they would say, hey, you know, we want to give a bike, or we want to do this, we want to do this, blah, 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 blah. And I would say, you know what? If you really want to do something for us, what you need to do is you need to build a relationship with us, and we need to sit down and we need to come up with a written contract of what you're going to contribute to the partnership and then what we're going to contribute to the partnership, because we do have something to offer you. And if you want to do that, then fine. If you don't, you know, well, then have a nice day. And I only had one church in 7 years who took me up on that. One church. One church who just didn't want to come down and do what they felt like we needed, you know. Because I was very big on, yeah, we're a church in the hood, but we contribute. We are a vibrant body of Christ, and we have something to give to you. Because we may live in a capitalistic society, but I'm Christian, and just because you have more money than us don't mean you better than us. Doesn't mean the spirit... let me shut up. I'm going to start preaching. But it doesn't mean the spirit ain't moving down here. You know, don't say, come on, let me pass the mic.
I can't top that at all. So, but I do have a short story where we were at a soup kitchen, and I was... they had people who were serving food. They had enough people for that. And so I was sitting at the tables, and one guy named Big Willie, he was telling me, he's like, oh, you think you're going to come here and feed us, you know, do all this stuff for us, similar to what you were saying. He said, what you need to do is shut up and listen to me. Shut up and hear my story. Find out who I am. And I did. I mean, it was really powerful. Big Willie had some great stories, and I learned a lot from him. He knew his Bible better than I did, and he really inspired me. I looked up to him a lot. We met every Saturday morning over that table, and I never served, never had to.
So, did you have something to say, Dingo? Go ahead.
I just think about after I was in New Orleans doing Katrina and had the experience walking through the water and experience going to the Superdome. But after all of that took place, I went to Texas, and I always hate the fact that people want to just throw money towards you and think that's going to help the problem. Like when I went there, you know, I had all these people, I'm going to write you a check for $500. I'm going to give you all these shoes. I'm going to give you all these clothes, and everything's going to be okay. But in reality, even if I received all of that, it wasn't okay, because I was dealing with something that was bigger than clothes, money, and whatnot. I needed somebody to talk to. Just a couple of days ago, before I came out here, I had this lady on Facebook. She sent me a message, and she was like, hey, I would like to write a check to you guys just to help out with everything. And I kind of just was like, you want to write a check to help? I'm like, yeah, you can buy some equipment to help us. You know, the guys have new basketballs, and you know, maybe we can buy some jerseys and whatnot. Yeah, that's helpful. But these guys need people that's going to come down, and that's going to give time, and that's actually going to listen to their story, like David was saying. It wasn't that I needed clothes and money. It was that I needed somebody to say, hey, it's all right. Yeah, you just experienced the worst thing in your life, but God is going to see you through. I needed people like that. People that just wanted to go walk to the park. People that just wanted to go shoot a basketball. People who wanted to go run routes in a football field. Not people who just throwing me money and clothes and all these materialistic things. So it's like when we partner with people, it's like, let's just stop saying, hey, take this $1,000 check and help the ministry. Yeah, that is useful at times. Yeah, it's needed. But let's start saying, hey, with that $1,000, I'm going to buy 6 people in my youth group a plane ticket down to New Orleans to be there for you, to listen, to pray with you, just to hear what you have to say. So that's what I think about it.
Actually, I think our time is wrapping up. Will you guys be able to be here for a few minutes if people have questions? So these guys will stick around if you have questions. Another thing is I want to let you know, I have a list, and not all of my questions were like the first two where it was all like defined big term things. Some of it's just real practical stuff, but I have a list of questions that are in the back that can help maybe just further the conversation, and you can walk away from here, and just as you're interacting with people, these are some maybe some questions that can help, particularly if you go in with an attitude of wanting to hear and learn and not defend, which has been my case in the past, wanting to defend myself and prove that I was okay. But when I was able to just step back and say, help me understand, that's when I was really able to, I think, start to understand. So there's this. Another couple things. Scott mentioned the videos he does. He's with Urban Entry. You can look those up, I think, on YouTube or Google them. And do you guys have a booth here?
They're at the bookstore.
Okay, so those are at the bookstore. Alvin has written a book, Reconciliation 101, a handbook for ministry leaders. So those are a couple resources. There's a ton of resources out there. So to just kind of further the conversation, but thank you for being here. And again, the whole point of this is that we would be living in rich relationships with each other, understanding how we're different, celebrating how we're different, and walking in unity together within that in a richer way. So thank you for being here. And I think we're finished. There are survey things, I think, in the back, which is normal. Yeah, the evaluation things to fill out. So.
You sparked an observation when you said what you said about this evening. I represent what I guess I'm a white middle class.
Thanks for your honesty.
Mm-hmm. Republican, everything that everybody hates in America nowadays. But my observation, you say being, you want to be. I don't think, that paternalistic thing strikes me that people want to have a cause that they can feel good about who they are. Activism can come that, but taking too far. People sitting back and going, I'm going to throw money and whatever at you because they can feel better about who they are, because they want to feel better about who they are, instead of focusing on what Alvin was saying, that we are meeting Christ. Our goal is set here, and we are moved because of our love for Christ for others. We see the world as Christ. And it disheartens me that we start, and I'm not denying that. I have no business saying there is nothing like that. Because I work in an organization there. I work with homeless and I work with multi-ethnic, But the issue is sometimes a human issue. It's not always a divisive, here I'm a racist or I'm a...
I don't know that it always comes from that way.
Yeah.
But it often feels that way.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
From folks looking at that.
Yeah, that makes me feel better about me. It's not about that.
Yeah.
It's not about my heart for people. It's about me feeling better about myself. And I just, to me, that's a very insidious thing where Satan likes to use the division of race. And I'm not saying there's a racial issue, but there are terrible racist people that just are not good people. But I think that we use the human condition. We often kind of try and make too much terms of this is this when it's just an issue of Satan doing bad things.
Right. That's the only way that comes
from. But it resonated. When you said it resonated, I thought this is not only a race issue, this is a human condition issue.
Right. Well, some of us are, we're active. I'd like to see
things.
And so then we want to go, build a house.
Right. And that is who we are. Right. Exactly.
It's hard for us to put him out.
I will never be an activist, but I can be radical in my relationship with Christ. If my eye is on the cross, I'm a radical by nature. You know? Because I don't get arrested as a radical.
Yeah, exactly. And he was an actor. And he was a holistic approach.
But it just really resonated with me what you said. I appreciate what you said. It was difficult to hear what everybody was saying. You know, but as the enemy, I think also white culture has an identity crisis, a huge identity crisis. And we don't know. I come from, 15 different, ethnicities at once. So I'm a mongrel.
Yeah. My mom's side, mostly English, but my grandfather came from a German family. I don't know anything about that.
Right.
For whatever reason, we weren't necessarily taught to value that.
Right. Well, as a matter of fact, we were.
And depending on when you came, leave that behind. Don't talk your language. Fit in, whatever. I think that's why. Right. So, there may be times when my personal engagement in this thing is not about individual race, but it is still colored by institutional race, societal race, and so it's going to, even if